This episode of the West Side Discussion is sponsored by Mando Discware and Birdie Fuel Coffee. Use code WSD10 to save 10%. Welcome back to the West Side Discussion podcast, the first and only podcast dedicated to West Side Discs. This is episode 8. My name is Jay. Thanks for listening. This week, I'm joined by Erica Stinchcomb. Erica just finished up another year as a full-time touring pro. Erica, welcome. How are you doing today?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for coming on. Where are you at right now?
I'm in Kingston, New York. My husband and I did a little bit of kind of just fun sightseeing and traveling after the tour wrapped up for me at Winthrop at the Throw Pink University. And I did some commentary, I guess, for the Pro Tour Championship in Charlotte. So did a couple weeks of travel, and now I'm kind of starting the off season.
Nice. Now, we see like on your Instagram, you know, during the week, a lot of pictures of you know, where you're at. Get a lot of great sightseeing in. Is that planned ahead of time, or you just kind of explore and see what's there?
Yeah, we got a calendar for every day of the year. My husband travels with me full time or at least for the whole year, which is great. And he kind of has a jurisdiction over our we use air quotes for off days. And I think we would both like to be a little bit more casual and relaxed and like, oh, let's go check this out. But with COVID and everything and people traveling and working remotely, you really have to plan ahead to see some of the more popular spots along the tour. So definitely plan. There's a little bit of flexibility. I wish there was a little more, but we definitely have to make a point of it to do it. But it's worth it.
It looks like you're having a lot of fun. I mean, the pictures are definitely beautiful. So it looks like it's worth it for sure.
Yeah.
So I want to dive in, start talking about disc golf. Before we do, I want to pause for a second and say thank you again to Mando Discware for their continued sponsorship. If you haven't checked out their lineup, you really got to check it out. A great lineup of apparel, shirts, hats, joggers. And now that it's cooling off everywhere, they got hoodies to keep you warm on the course. The clothes are comfortable. They allow you to send it with style. So check them out, mandodiscware.com. If you use code WSD10 at checkout, you save 10%. That's WSD10. And Erica, for being a guest on the podcast, we want to send you a free item of your choice.
I'll check it out.
Yep, absolutely. So let's start from the beginning. Who taught you how to play disc golf?
My dear old dad. He took me and my brother when we were 16. He actually took me once when I was 8, and I wish it stuck then. Like, I remember it, but we only went one time at Morley Field, and then 8 years later, I guess he got the urge again to go. he played a little bit growing up at Morley Field. Back when he was like teenager or in his 20s or something like that. And then didn't really play much. So I should ask him, like, what made you take us this one time? But as soon as we went, I was 16 and my brother was probably 17. And we were just totally hooked and got into it a little bit on our own. But our dad also got more into it. We were going every single weekend, getting up at the crack of dawn to beat the crowds to the course.
And where's Morley Field?
It's in San Diego.
Okay. So he took you when you were 8 and then again 16. Did he go, so he didn't play any time between there?
I don't think so, no. Or I'm pretty sure he didn't.
Okay.
Yeah.
So after that, did you and your brother keep playing?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. So we played, my brother left home around 19. So he and I played together for 2 years with my dad a lot, maybe closer to 3. And then my dad and I kept going after my brother left until I left for college. And then, yeah, I kept playing casually in college just for fun, but I didn't start playing competitively even in amateur tournaments until after I graduated college.
Oh, where was college?
Missoula, Montana. It's pretty much what I call home today as well. Love it there.
What brought you up to Montana? School, like specific school or just?
Yeah, the University of Montana has a really excellent postcard campaign, I'd say, and they hooked me in. I kind of applied there as a backup school.
So basically just their advertising.
Yeah. Straight up, yeah, good for them. That's how they got, that's where my husband and I met, Ian. He also agrees that they have an excellent postcard campaign, and that's how we ended up applying there. So,
well, it worked.
Yep.
Well, when you and brother playing, were you competitive with each other, or were you just more casual?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you got to beat your brother, you know, and if you're him, you can't let your little sister beat you.
So does he play now still, or?
Some, he actually lived in Pensacola, Florida for a while. He's in the Air Force, and he played casually there a little bit, but it was kind of a ways to get to any course. And now he's stationed in Italy, and there's no courses around him. So poor guy's just got to enjoy the beauties of Italy without as much disc golf. But yeah, it's definitely still a hobby of his for sure.
Yeah, must be rough. Just beauty of Italy.
Mm-hmm.
So you went to college at Montana. What'd you study there?
Athletic training. So like sports medicine, basically.
You still doing that now?
No, I did. So I worked full-time for a while after college. Went to Seattle, worked at Boeing, actually, where they build planes. And so I did injury prevention and things like exercise classes and things like that for a lot of the airplane plane mechanics and even the desk workers. Sitting in a chair for hours and hours a day isn't good for you either. But that was like very preventative versus I moved back to Missoula and worked in a high school setting where you're on the field and if an athlete falls, like it's your job to go over there and assess the injury and also kind of managing like fires and air quality and lightning and any kind of environmental, you know, monitoring and just making sure that everybody's safe. So yeah, I did that full time through the 2019, I believe. And then in 2020, I was doing that part time, but I intended to tour full time in 2020. So I ended up not because of COVID. So I just kind of kept working part time. And now I'm not really using that at all, which is fine. I kind of became an athletic trainer because I thought I was going to be an athlete. Like I thought I was going to play soccer in college or, you know, be a wildland firefighter or do something athletic in it. It wasn't really turning out that way. So athletic training was a way for me to stay around athletics.
Okay. Have you been in contact with Disc Golf Strong or anything or thought about any partnership with them?
Yeah. Seth Munsey and I talk about that a lot, actually. I mean, if I wanted to just quit playing right now and dive into a partnership with Seth, I think we both would be interested in making that work. I think that our specialties align really well to, you know, do something with that. I mean, he's already doing a lot and he's on the PDGA medical board, I believe, and he's at all the pro tour events and he's doing some of the things actually that an athletic trainer does, like creating emergency action plans and things like that. He has a lot of EMT experience. So not that he's like not qualified to be doing that, don't get me wrong, but he has a pretty big area of expertise that he's covering largely by himself. But that's not really something that I could do, I think, like part-time, because you have to be available throughout the entire tournament to, you know, potentially, like, I would imagine if I was doing that job with Seth that I would be available throughout the tournament and practice days, and if people are injured, they could come talk to me and ask, hey, what do you think about this? How do I get this better? Is this something I can play on? Or something like, you know, someone tears their ACL or falls and hurts their wrists, like, is it broken? Can I play? That kind of thing. That's kind of what I think I would do as an athletic trainer, like let them know whether it's safe to play and how to get things better and, you know, maybe do some taping and bracing and that kind of stuff. But that's a full-time gig. It's part of the reason I'm not working as an athletic trainer right now. It really takes everything I have and I can't do that and try to be a professional disc golfer at the same time. But I imagine that later in my career when I'm kind of done playing, done-ish, you know, playing less, that I bring athletic training into disc golf. That's kind of where I see my future going.
Yeah, that'd be a great path for sure. So you said you didn't start doing any tournaments until like after college. So that was in Seattle when you started doing tournaments first?
Well, I played my first one in Missoula right before I moved to Seattle as I was waiting on my job application to Boeing. And a friend of mine just said, hey, I want to play this tournament. He wanted to play an intermediate men. We used to play together all the time. Mm-hmm. His name's Sean Nevins. And Sean was like, yeah, I want to play, but I'm kind of nervous to do this by myself. Like, do you want to play this tournament? And I told him, no, that's ridiculous. Like, I pay money to play disc golf. Like, you're an idiot.
Right, it's
and
free.
And he actually spotted me the entry fee, so I'd do it. Yeah, like, what are you doing? And I had a great time. I actually, my first card was with, like, the Masters women. I think they were Masters amateur women, which was great because it was, you know, a learning curve and I didn't have a disc marker. I didn't know any of the rules. And so they were like very kind and yeah, just very welcoming. And then I played my second round with like a, you know, card of advanced women. And I had actually never played with any other women ever before that day. Like, you know, sometimes a girlfriend of a guy I was playing with would come along or whatever, but it was just kind of a novelty. Like, there's more and more women playing now, which is great, but just, I don't know what it was. Wherever I was playing, there just wasn't really any woman that took the sport seriously. So I was hooked immediately. Like, I knew that, I just thought it would be as an amateur, but that I would be playing disc golf tournaments for years and years to come after that. And then I moved to Seattle and, let's see, moved in like August or something like that, September. And the season for tournaments was kind of wrapping up. And I played, my second tournament ever was the SeaTac, what do they call it? It was just an ice bowl, I think, in February of 2016, I think. Wait, maybe it's 2015. What is time?
Right.
Whatever year I start, it must have been 2016. But anyway, it was terrible. I literally only wanted to play to like meet some other women that would play, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a 7-hour round. It was raining the whole time. My umbrella broke. I was on a card with two guys and like an elderly woman who like we didn't hit it off super
seven
well.
7 hours.
and yeah, it was one because it's 27 holes.
Got it.
Yeah. And so I was like, God, what, this is terrible. Is this what this is like? And I didn't have any snacks. The first tournament I played was Zootown Open, which is in my hometown, Missoula. It was great. They have a catered lunch for you every year. So I thought like food was included with your entry fee, which is not true. It's funny. That's how I actually met Tina Oakley. She played on the card of like five women that played besides like my smaller card,
mm-hmm.
which is the one other woman, an advanced woman. And Tina came up to me afterwards and was like, hey, do you want to hang out? We're going to go get dinner. And I said, no, I'm very tired and cold and hungry. I'm just going to go home, which is hilarious because now we're such great friends. And I did, you know, end up that my only goal at that tournament was to just meet people I could play with and maybe compete with. And so that it did happen that way. But it's funny because I totally blew her off, like 100%. And now we're best of friends.
Yeah, it's crazy how you set out that goal to meet people and you know, met one of your best friends there. So did you start playing with Tina immediately after that, or how did you guys meet back up again then?
Pretty much. It was like a month after that. And the scene in Seattle is kind of interesting. It's kind of really spread out, like strung up out north and south. And so you either play in the north or in the south, and they kind of have like different groups. But neither one had a ton of women that played. And I've been playing with guys my whole life, so I was just trying to like find tournaments and compete with women. And there wasn't a big scene for that at that time, though I think it's growing. But I noticed Portland had a lot of tournaments, so I went and played one. Let's see, I think it was in Bonneville. It was on the Columbia River just outside Portland, and I found Tina on Facebook and kind of fished around like, hey, do you know anywhere I could camp in the area? And she offered, you know, oh, just stay with me. And I was like, oh, you know, yes, because that's what I was shooting for.
Fishing for that invite.
Right. So we just hit it off from there. And I started to play in Portland a lot because they have a great women's scene and they have 60 plus courses or something like that. They have a ton of courses and a ton of tournaments. And that's really where I kind of got my start as a advanced women competitor.
Yeah. Madison Tomano was on last time and she was talking about the Portland scene and a lot of the women disc golf up there.
Yeah. We actually played a time or two together back in the Portland days, maybe even more than that, but a couple times that I remember. And it's funny, we just played together at Portland Open this year, now that we're both on the team. And as professionals, this is our first time playing as pros together. We're like, man, we haven't played together since like 2017 amateur days, you know? So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, how it all comes back full circle.
Mm-hmm.
So when did touring start for you?
Well, let's see. After I met Tina, she said something like, hey, I'm going to California to play this tournament. Do you want to come? And I was like, yeah. And so that was the first time I traveled. And that was 2016, May of 2016, played Daisy Chains. That was still an advanced women's tournament, or for me, you know. But it's really cool. They have all divisions mixed together the first round. So I played with Zoe Andyke. She was the first pro I ever met. Who, you know, I asked, oh, what do you do for a living? And she said this. And I didn't even know you could do that, you know.
Wait, this is a thing?
Yeah. So anyway, I played advanced and kind of bumped up to pro a couple times just to dip my toes in the water towards the end of 2016. And then in, I want to say 2017 was when I did like a mini tour by myself, unsponsored, just me and my old Ford van, and just took off and gave it a shot.
So what was it like touring without a sponsor then? How did you make that work?
Oh, it was super hard. It's not undoable, but unless you just like have a bunch of money on your own, it's really, really difficult. But I just thought I'd give it a shot till the money ran out and see if I liked it. Like, you know, I had this idea of, yeah, I think I would like to do this, but can I make it work? What's the lifestyle like? That kind of thing. So I basically built out a small camper van and then just moved into that by myself for, I want to say, 5 months while I was still working at Boeing. So I saved up a bunch of money. My husband was working in the Philadelphia area at the time with his sister, where he grew up. So like I kind of had was left to my own devices, and I was like, well, I'll just kind of be semi-homeless and make as much money as I can, and then I'll take off from here. So that's what I did, and it worked okay. It was tough because I didn't know that many people, and I was only 860 rated, and I really didn't cash very much, which wasn't necessarily the point. Like, I didn't expect to go out there and win everything or cash all the time. Like, at that time, you were lucky to get a field of 20. So, I mean, cashing meant you had to be in the top eight. Like, it was, I don't want to say impossible, but like a very tall order. So anyway, having Tina and then Eric Oakley on the road, they really helped me like meet people. And, you know, the disc golf community is so generous, and it's pretty easy to reach out and just park in people's driveways and have a place to shower, and you know, there's help if you look for it. But yeah, you definitely have to kind of put yourself out there a lot and ask for help. And, you know, I don't want to say swallow your pride, but like, life on the road is expensive to like maybe have some privacy and some amenities and things like that. And so you do have to give up a certain amount if you're trying to save money.
So with the state of disc golf where it is today, do you think it'd be easier or harder for someone to go out as a non-sponsored player?
I think financially, it's not that different. The entry fees are maybe a little bit more expensive now for a lot of the bigger tournaments. But, you know, you're going to spend a couple thousand just on entry fees if you don't have any kind of sponsor that's paying for those. So at least probably two to maybe closer to 4,000, depending on how many tournaments. So, like, that's a big expense that often your sponsor is going to take care of. So even that part's tough. Plus gas and food. So like, unless, I think you'd have to do what I did, at least to some extent, and like save up and know that you're going to be in a deficit while you do it for a while. Unless you expect to cash all the time. And at least on the women's side, that is getting a little bit easier. On the men's side, it's maybe getting harder because there's so many men that are really, really good. On the women's side, like, there's just as many or more women that are really, really good, but now there's often 40 in an event. So getting, you know, 18th instead of 8 to cash is like a lot more reasonable. So yeah, it's not going to be that different. I don't think it's very sustainable. Like, at some point you're going to need a sponsor to help you out to pay for some of those entry fees and have some sort of like travel stipend to help you out, because gas can really add up and even just food can really add up. But I think the thing that would be different now, especially going into next year, is now that the Pro Tour is essentially in charge of the entire professional tour, and they're moving to like a pro tour card system where every single player has to have like a tour card, or you have to play like a qualifying tournament. I think that's the direction they're going. As they phase into it, I think there will still be some tournaments that are like ratings based registration, but I believe they're moving towards like you have to either have pre-qualified to get into this tournament, or you have to play a qualifying tournament to play this bigger tournament. So from that standpoint, it's going to be harder for just anybody to sign up for a tournament. Like, when I started, I was, like I said, 860 rated. And I mean, there are registration windows, but basically you can get into whatever you want. You can just call yourself a professional and get into a tournament.
Right.
Like, it's not that hard if you're paying attention. It's harder now, like tournaments fill up faster. So I guess that would be another barrier to like maybe an unsponsored player if you're lower rated and you're working your way up. But yeah, I guess overall it would probably be a little bit harder because our sport is just growing in size and professionalism.
So thinking back to like your early disc golf, so you started, you know, you learned to play in Southern California, you moved to the mountains in college, played there, moved to the Pacific Northwest and played there. Did that variety help prepare you for touring and playing in different types of courses?
For the most part, yeah. California is more like park style and like Morley Field, the pin placements changed a lot. So you definitely learned a lot of shots, but there's not really any woods where I played. So I learned that in college. It's a very elevated, hilly and wooded course. I would say the main things that I didn't learn were how dense some of the rough can be in the Midwest in particular. Like, I'm used to being able to scramble from anywhere. So getting into somewhere where it's just like thorns and vines and you literally have to pitch out, like, I've never pitched out before going to some of those courses. And something like Idlewild, the first time I played that, I was like, this is the hardest course on the entire planet. Like, how am I supposed to hit a 6-foot gap 150 feet away from me? There's a lot more like smaller fairway trees on some of the courses, like in the Midwest and the East, and even in like somewhere like Dogwood in Texas. So I definitely had to learn other skills, but I was, I think, relatively well-rounded when I started.
That's nice. So then, so that was your 2017 kind of mini tour. How many months was that? How long did that go?
That went, let's see. I mean, I started pretty much at the beginning. I want to say I started in March. I started at Las Vegas. So in February. And then I think I made it all the way to Worlds, which was in, I believe, Augusta that year in like August. And then I think I pretty much went home after that, but I did qualify for the Pro Tour Championships and flew out to Florida that year to do that. That was actually the only time I've competed in those, just because I played so many that I qualified. I think I played 18 events, which is, that's a full load, slate of events, I guess, for any pro. So it's almost not even a mini tour. It was kind of a real tour. I just missed a couple of the East Coast ones after Worlds.
Got it. Okay. So then after that tour, was the next year touring, you know, for sure? Or did, was there still kind of some debate about that?
Oh, no, I was like totally broke and had to move back to Missoula and get a real job. And it actually wasn't the tour that totally made me broke. It was like moving back into like real society. Like, oh, I have to get an apartment again and buy furniture, which I haven't had to have, and things like that. And it took me a little longer to get a job than I thought when I moved back to Missoula. So I was definitely like in the red for a while after my mini tour. So in 2018, I played like 10 events, but I was kind of just like recovering financially and, you know, knew that that's like where I wanted to go. But unlike a lot of like, I don't know, some of the younger people who have started touring, like I have college debt and like racked up some credit card debt from various like life expenses, you know, like mostly car problems, whatever, you know, like real life happens. So I knew it would probably take me a couple years to get out fully on tour the way I wanted. And I didn't even get a sponsor until partway into 2018, actually.
And that was Westside? Your first sponsor?
Yeah, they're my only disc manufacturing sponsor I've ever had. So the way that happened is, I actually wanted to apply to Dynamic Disc after my first tour in 2017. I just liked how they treated their players and had kind of the inside scoop with the Oakleys, you know, and just kind of got to see the inner workings of that company a little bit more than some of the other ones. But their team was super stacked. And so I was going to apply at the end of 2017. I was like, what do I even have to offer? Like, I don't think I'm even going to be able to play much next year. You know, this and that. So I didn't even do it. And then I was out at the memorial and Tina told me, you know, well, DD actually just kind of acquired Westside and it's the same people who I talked to, who, you know, specifically Robert McCall was managing the team. So she's like, maybe you should talk to Robert about getting on Westside because they don't have really a lot of players on the team. So it'd probably be a good match even though you're not playing as much. So I did and I got sponsored that day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was cool, and I don't want to say happenstance, but it definitely did work out, and it's been neat because I feel like, I mean, I would like to stay with Westside for the very long foreseeable future, and I feel like my progress as a professional and also just like even some brand recognition and like the way that Westside has grown, at least in the States. It's like, I feel like my name in Westside is kind of like synonymous in a way.
Yeah.
Or that's how I would like it to be. You know, I feel like they've helped me and I think that I've helped them. I mean, I'm whatever. I have a hard time like talking about myself, but I think it's been a really positive thing overall, and looking forward to more big things with them.
So kind of talk about that. So you do have your Team Series Sword coming out. Is this your first Team Series disc you've had with them, sold yes. through Dynamic Discs?
Yes. So it's a big move for me. Those are Tournament X swords. So, and they're coming out, I still don't have the exact date, but mid-November,
okay.
I believe. So that'll be really cool, and it'll be super nice not having to sell them myself, and they're sold right there on the Dynamic Disc website. So it's
a lot more convenient.
Yeah, big for me.
I got to tell you, personally, I can't wait for it to come out, because I got your hybrid sword, Hybrid X sword. Got my first ace with it.
Oh, awesome.
But I can't retire it yet.
Yeah.
But I can't retire it yet because I need a replacement. So I can't wait for that to come out so I can put that one, take it out of my bag so I don't worry about losing it. So speaking of your other swords, you were selling those through Skybreed as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did sell a lot of the hybrids through them this year. They're a new sponsor for me. My teammate on Westside Discs, Chris Baker, is the team captain for Skybreed. He lives pretty close to their shop in Bowling Green, Indiana. And he, reached out and asked if I was interested. And I didn't really know, like, what they could offer or what I could offer them. Like, I'm not even close to where you guys are. Like, but we chatted. I talked to Justin Taylor, who's the owner. And we vibe pretty well. And we kind of came to the agreement that it's really hard for me to sell discs on the road in a small traveling vehicle. And that they could sell discs for me and give me pretty, like, healthy royalties on everything. And they've been honestly great. They've gone above and beyond everything we kind of agreed to. And I feel very lucky to have them as, you know, they've sold a ton of just core fundraisers for me, as well as a lot of the Two Hot Geese discs and merchandise that we've had. Really anything I've been like, hey, do you want to sell this? They're like, yeah, please. So the new swords that are my official tour series are a DD exclusive, so they won't be through Skybreed. But pretty much everything else that helps me stay on tour is sold through Skybreed. So it's been a great partnership.
Speaking of sponsors, I want to pause one more time and say thank you to Birdy Fuel Coffee for sponsoring this episode. Birdy Fuel is another great way to enjoy a delicious cup of coffee and also supporting a player. You can buy some coffee and support Chris Clemens, Kristen Tatar, Eric and Tina Oakley, we've been talking about, Eric McCabe, and others. So if you like disc golf and coffee, check out their offerings at birdiefuelcoffee.com. Pick up a bag based on taste or your favorite player. You can't go wrong on that, trust me. And when you order, use code WSD10 and save 10%. That's WSD10. All right, so going back to Westside in 2018, kind of that tour. Was that a more full-time tour in 2018?
No. Yeah, like I said, I was just financially recovering. I think I only played 10 events, but I was working two jobs. I was working like 50 to 60 hours a week, just, you know, trying to get out of various debt. So I did not play very much in 2018. 2019 was pretty close to a full-time tour. I was still working just as much. So it was a really exhausting year, honestly. I was, working pretty easily 50 hours a week, but I was working in high school athletics. Like, there are certain times of the year where, like, the kids are on break and things like that, where you can kind of range out for a couple weeks and play tournaments. So, like, I would just go for long weekends. Like, I'd work through Thursday and then I would drive somewhere, and like, sometimes I wouldn't even practice before the tournament, you know, if it was a local one, and I just play and then I'd drive back Sunday night and then go to work on Monday. More often I would take like a week or two off and try to get, you know, a couple of tournaments if it was 2 weeks. And then I was able to take the summer off to play a bunch of events that summer. So that was like, let's see, I want to say that one was 17 events. So for working like a full-time job and a part-time job as well, I was working REI part-time and working as an athletic trainer full-time. It was a good year. Like, I actually did, that was the year I did pretty well at Worlds. I got on coverage, I think, for my first time ever, played on the lead card.
Oh, nice.
The second day of Worlds. I ended up finishing 12th. I had one bad round, but four really great rounds. I think I had like an 880 rated round, but I still averaged like 950 golf on the weekend. I was pretty happy with the results and like financially stable enough on my own to know that like I can quit these jobs and go full time, especially with a little bit more help from Westside. And with that kind of full season under my belt, you know, now at this point, I'm now like 920 rated and have some decent finishes under my belt. I felt comfortable for asking like more help from Westside, which they have literally given me everything I've asked for so far. I should probably ask for more. A little rough out here. A lot of kind of mid to lower level professional disc golfers aren't raking in a lot of the big bucks, you know. Mm-hmm. Most of us are just trying to kind of scrape by and, you know, be okay. But anyway, in 2019, I had enough results to kind of be able to ask Westside for more help, which they granted me, and I was going to do my first full-time tour, like not working any other jobs, fully on tour in 2020. And I started to do that, and then COVID happened. And I kind of tried to play, let's see, I think the first event I played after COVID, I played Vegas in the Memorial, and then I skipped Waco, and that's the one where they had to cancel the last round because of COVID. And then I went out and tried to play DDO, but honestly, I just felt uncomfortable. It didn't feel particularly safe to me to be traveling so much and, you know, exposed to so many people all over the place. Like, it was really hard to, in my opinion, stay safe. And I just didn't feel comfortable touring, which was a massive bummer. I mean, I was literally going to quit my jobs to finally, like, live my dreams and, you know, have like enough support, outside support from my sponsors to do this, like particularly Westside. To give that up for a year was really tough and kind of a massive setback. I'm turning 30 this year. So I kind of have a timeline in my head of how I want things to go, and to just give up a whole year was really, really hard. This year was great though. 2021, I got to hit the road full time. I started in a truck and a camper. My husband was able to go with me. The camper was kind of a mistake. Towing kind of sucks, and it was really, really old, and we were like really pressed to like buy something or just like, you know, Airbnb and hotel or find people to stay with, but that's like its own set of stresses. And I took a month off in July, and we dumped the trailer and bought a van instead, which is not built out, so it's just a van full of junk that we've been driving since July. It's been a lot. So I'm going to say that.
So you don't even have the trailer anymore.
No, we got rid of it like on a whim. So it's been like a wild ride.
Earlier you mentioned two hot geese. What are two hot geese?
It's me, Erica Stinchcomb, and my partner, Madison Walker. The way that started, it's like not a quick story, unfortunately. So it's like kind of hard to explain. I did make a little video that's, on my Instagram, and there's a little YouTube video about it. But in 2019, when I started to do a little bit of commentary, Madison and I were doing commentary for the Las Vegas Challenge in 2019 with Terry Miller. And the first round, he said, I'm going to put something cute in the intro when your guys' names are on there, but he didn't tell us what. And so the next day we saw that they were little geese. And so then we were like, oh man, we look really cute as geese day two. And I think day three, she was like, oh wow, we look great as geese. And I was like, yeah, two hot geese. And we laughed. And then round four, we just owned it. We're like, we're the two hot geese, I guess. And you know, and it just stuck. Like, I mean, that's kind of our style. Like, we like to keep it lighthearted and entertaining and still try to provide, you know, quality information and technical information to help people follow along and learn. But also, like, to me, it's just really boring if all a commentator is doing is stating what's happening. Like, you can use your eyes for that,
right? Yeah. I can see it
and form your own, you know, like, conclusions. Yeah, like, I don't know, there's gotta, to me, it's the added value is, you know, having a little bit of entertainment and having some fun with it. And I know that's not everybody's style, and that's fine, to each their own, but I don't know, we actually have like a pretty good group of like diehard fans that they honk at us like in comments on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And in person. I can't tell you how many times this year Like, they announce my name to tee off and someone honks at me and it makes me laugh every time. I love it. If you're listening and you're a Too High Geese fan, honk at me anytime.
All right. So is the Too High Geese going to keep going on for next year?
I think so. We have a good relationship with GK Pro and they definitely want to keep working with us. But, you know, things change so fast with the media and the tour and who knows if they're going to keep going with FPO. So, I mean, we've all made it clear that it's our intentions. Like, we want to keep doing it. They want us to keep doing it. So hopefully it should happen, but it's hard to say anything for sure with the state of our game changing so much all the time.
All right. And you're also the team manager for Team Wilsax, correct?
Yeah, I manage the tour team specifically. There's a few different levels. You know, there's juniors and there's like ambassadors and things like that. But yeah, I manage the tour team.
Okay. And what are your responsibilities there?
Largely just to see if any of the team members, you know, need anything, like if they're low on whale sacks and need some and things like that. But I would say mostly it's just making sure that they get their set of custom whale sacks to sell as fundraisers or be sold on the website as fundraisers. So I actually make whale sacks on the side. It's okay. My side hustle and my sponsor. So a lot of times I've actually designed some of the, and maybe not the logos and things like that, but like helped put together the fabric and then like physically made their whale sacks for them to give to them. And I mean, I could outsource it and have someone else make them for me, but I'm making them anyway. So it was a pretty easy thing to just, you know, I'm on tour and see people all the time. So yeah, I think it's been pretty good. I definitely have my hands in too many, what's the phrase?
Too many pots.
Too many pots, I guess. Yeah, I have a little bit too much going on to feel like I'm doing a super good job with that, but like I largely got everyone everything they needed, I think, for the most part this year.
All right. So looking at a tournament, you're planning for a tournament. What does success look like for you in a tournament?
Well, I mean, I kind of set general goals for like each round and each day. And, you know, every tournament you at least want to cash, right? For anybody to think, like, yeah, going into this tournament, I just want to make the cash line, which is usually the top 40%. I have various goals. Like I just want to feel like I'm not, like spiraling out of control or like I have one bad hole and then it affects my whole round. Like if I can take each hole one at a time, which is super cliche, but absolutely true, you know, can shake off bad shots and continue to throw good shots, and throw like good shots under pressure. Like that's successful to me, even if overall it didn't go that well. So I try to play each tournament like that, because if I'm just going for having a clean mental game, like I know my physical skills are good enough to get me into, you know, the top 10 or top 5. I think I struggle more like mentally, you know, I have one bad hole or one bad shot and it turns into 6 bad holes and then I have to dig myself out, or I have one bad round in the beginning and then I have to like climb my way up the next couple of rounds. So I think if I can just mentally, you know, be calm and take each hole as it comes and not get mad at a rollaway and like all those little things, and just like mentally be at peace with the round and how I'm playing, like the results are going to start showing for themselves. Before I used to like write down various goals, like no double bogeys, like only 2 out of bounds. Like, you know, I think this hole is like I used to add them like pars. I'd be like, okay, this is like a par 4, but I'm going to call it a 3.5 because I probably can birdie this half the time. And I'd like add up all my 0.5s and stuff like that and like write notes to myself. And I had all of these things and like a results-based system. And I don't know, I feel like that sets you up for failure in a way, like if you don't meet those goals. So I think I do better having just vague goals, like just chill out and enjoy disc golf today and know that this is your job and that you could be sitting at some crappy desk somewhere and stuck inside. And like, you know, so just, yeah, kind of having that vague, like calm goal in mind, I think is, a good way for, like, that's typically when I play better. And then another way to be successful is just like make sure that I am not working on tournament days, which is really hard. Like when you can work all the time selling discs or making whales or doing commentary, or doing all of those things at once, sometimes it gets really hard to focus on just disc golf. So like a successful tournament is minimizing the outside work that I do, because I always play better if I do that, but it's still really hard. Like my mind is always like, we need to make money right now, which is not a great way to be calm out on the course, like stressing about a couple of bucks, you know? So if I can minimize my workload and just take things one hole at a time, like whether the tournament goes good or bad, I'm not going to be too mad at myself.
What part of your game is your greatest strength?
I'm a really good scrambler, generally. Like, I'm not afraid to kind of take some of the riskier shots that can pay off. Like, I can throw the worst drive I've ever thrown and then still par the hole, you know? So that really helps. And actually, even more than that, I would say the best part of my game is just my touch approach shots. I can usually park them within 15 feet if I'm like within 200 or 250, something like that. Like it's really easy to leave those at like 30 or 35 feet and give yourself a stressful putt. But that was the biggest thing I learned playing with my dad. I mean, from day one, I could outdrive him, but he beat me like every single round because he would just park it. And, you know, when you're an amateur, like no one can putt, neither of us could putt at all, like outside of like 15, you know, like your 20 footers look so far as an amateur player or a casual player, and like 25-30, like, yeah, it's a 2 out of 10, you know, kind of a thing. So anyway, I just learned how to approach really well, and when I started playing pro, I was a horrible putter, just horrible, because I didn't have to do it that often. So yeah, I definitely kept that. And that's just like so much practice and feeling. It's the only part of my game I don't have to think about. And actually probably scrambling too, is probably why I'm good at it. You kind of just commit to it. It's like, this is the only option I have. Like I know how to do this. Like I trust my body to do this right. And I don't even have to think about it, versus like on the tee, I'm like, what angle do I want to go to? And where's my aiming point? And what's the wind doing and all this stuff. When I'm approaching and scrambling, I kind of am just able to just trust my instincts and trust all the practice that I've put in and execute the shot. So I hope that the rest of my game gets there, because driving and putting, I feel like a psycho.
So what part of your game are you currently focused on improving?
Well, putting always, but I mean, I'm finally to the point where I can call myself a good putter, and that's saying a lot. I mean, I don't feel like a good putter. My heart beats very fast every single putt, even every 20 footer. I'm like unbelievably nervous. It's like kind of astounding to me that I've made so many putts like that, and I still am unbelievably nervous. I wonder if anybody else feels that way. Like probably not. Probably, like, let me know. So always putting, and then my forehand definitely needs some work.
Okay.
I used to be forehand dominant, and then my backhand became so good that I stopped throwing a lot of forehands. But the only forehand that I could confidently throw was like a turn, like a force flex with a overstable disc, which like works, but it's nice to have other shapes, right? It's nice to hyzer flip something or, you know, throw something straight down a tunnel. And I couldn't do any of that. So I've kind of went back to square one and relearned my forehands just like last year in 2020 during COVID, and then like started to trust myself throwing forehands. The first half of this year, every time I threw a forehand, I was like putting level nervous, just this could go anywhere, I don't know. And it wasn't until the later half of the year that I really started to trust myself. But distance wise, I'm probably only getting like not even 300 feet, maybe like 250, maybe 300 on a great forehand throw. So I'd like to be able to control my forehand distance. Okay. But my touch shots are really good inside, you know, 250. And then everyone always wants more distance. So
yeah, that always be nice.
I really want to work on my lower body engagement, like just getting my hips and my rotation better. Like my timing's really good and everything, like my arm angle and the way I hold my wrist and timing and all that stuff is good. But I've really just maxed out. Like there is energy that my body is wasting that's not going into the frisbee, so I really just want to like maximize all of my energy into the disc, because if I can do that, there's no reason I can't throw 400 feet.
So what's the rest of your off season going to look like?
My husband and I are seeing some friends and family right for the next couple weeks. I'm going to go see my parents next week, and we're going to start the van build. cut some of the big holes in it and, you know, put like the roof vents in and things like that. And let's see, we're going to be in Pensacola with the Oakleys for Thanksgiving. And then we're headed to South Florida where my husband's dad lives. And we'll be there for around a month, maybe a little more, 5 weeks or something. And so we'll kind of finish, hopefully finish, at least do most of the van build there. And I'll be really focusing on a lot of my training there. It'll be my first winter since I was in high school that like won't have snow. So that'll be nice, be easy to practice and train.
Oh yeah, that definitely is. So the van build then is for the 2022 season. You're going to be going out in the same capacity full time again?
Yeah, definitely. And this year I actually took a month off in July, just because Missoula in July is wonderful. And I couldn't quite pass it up. so I missed like 3 events. It was only supposed to be 2, but they added Des Moines Challenge after, I think it was the Sula Open was removed from the tour schedule. I don't know if I think that's right. But anyway, I was going to miss 2. It ended up being 3. And I think that's one of the reasons I didn't qualify for the Pro Tour Championships. I also just played better in a lot of the NTs mm-hmm. versus the Pro Tours, unfortunately. So like that didn't help me either. But yeah, the van's going to be for the 2022 season. I'm really excited. Next year looks a little chiller. Like this year there were stretches where you were going straight for 6 weeks. Like your off day was your travel day and you're driving hundreds of miles and then you're practicing, and then tournament, and then you do it again. You drive hundreds of miles, practice, tournament. And like I'm working my side hustles mm-hmm. on the side, you know, so like it was very fast paced, pretty grueling this year.
Is your husband going to be touring with you again?
Yeah. Yeah. He's good for 1 more year. I'm trying to keep him out for 2, but he's probably got to like rejoin society and think about his career too at some point.
What is his profession?
Ian graduated with a master's in public administration and it's really had a focus on nonprofit administration, specifically in like environmental capacities. His most recent job was with the DNRC, the Department of Natural Resources and Conservation, and he was doing like fire prevention stuff, primarily just educating the public on how to prevent wildfires since that's such a problem out west.
Oh, yeah.
That's not like kind of his true calling, but it was a good job for him. And he, you know, made enough money and did well enough that he was like, you know what, like, I'm just gonna go tour with you for a while. We had always planned on it. We were trying to get him out in 2023, but it just worked out timing wise. His job happened to end. He was just working a temporary job. Mm-hmm. And he was able to come, and it's been really great for me. He's a full-time caddy, but eventually if he could work like running an environmental nonprofit. Like he's worked a lot taking kids out on trail work and like building trails in Montana, things like that. So somewhere in that realm of like combining like really efficient bureaucracy and nature,
right.
That's like his 2 favorite things.
All right. So I did want to ask about the 2022 season. You made a post the other day that you were planning it and it took you a couple hours to plan. What all goes into that planning? What takes so long?
Oh, well, like I said, I mean, we have every day of 2022 already planned, essentially. I mean, it's flexible, but like I said, the pace is a bit better. So there are weeks, like there's typically an off week in between 2022's season, which is great. So tournament, an off weekend, and then another tournament. So there's some time to play with. So we both do enjoy like visiting national parks and recreating and hiking and that kind of thing in the outdoors. And it's kind of like soul recharging for me. So it's definitely a priority. My Instagram probably makes it look like I do that stuff more than I do, but it's important to me. So that's why it looks like that. So we're planning like mileage and where are we going to stay and where did we stay last year that, you know, would work, or like what are our priorities when we're in this area, and like looking at routes and like what national park can we hit from Kansas to OTB, or, you know, things like that. So we primarily just did the calendar part of it. There'll be another stretch probably in January, maybe even December, where we're like booking places to stay. We generally stay in campsites. Like I said, it's possible to reach out and stay with locals or friends and family and like pay less money, but just, you know, paying like 30 or 40 bucks a night, or sometimes 50 for a campsite, and having power and water and a place to kind of call home for a week or two is generally worth it. So like that'll be several hours and like a bunch of money right up front to just like make sure we're comfortable and have a home base. Like there were too many times this year that everywhere was already booked and we were like too late finding a place to stay, and it was really stressful or really far from the course or things like that. So planning ahead is maybe not a super strength of mine, but it's something that I've like realized is incredibly important and pays off later.
All right, cool. Thanks so much for coming on. This was a great conversation. Is there any last things you want to add, say, or plug?
No, thanks to Westside Dis. Everybody check out the Tournament X Series Swords coming out mid-November. Sorry, I don't have a date for you yet. Thanks to Whale Sacks, we talked about a little bit. Original sponsor, they're my first sponsor ever, and Skybreed Discs. And yeah, thank you, Jay. I wouldn't call it a conversation if I'm just kind of talking at you, but thanks for having me.
No, absolutely. Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. Thank you for listening. This is the Westside Discussion Podcast. I want to thank Erica again for coming on, and thank you to our sponsors, Mando Discware and Birdie Fuel Coffee. The theme song is What Would You Be Like by Akira the Don. We'll continue the discussion next time.